Abolish the Fed or just audit the Fed?
No, abolish the Fed.
You've been against tariffs, yet you've been defending Trump's tariffs, Peter. Yeah. Are you against tariffs in principle?
In theory, tariffs are terrible. They're a tax. All taxes are bad, always and everywhere. But in this case, I think Trump, so long as he keeps up with the tax cuts and the regulatory cuts, if you pair those with tariffs, I think it's pretty good.
You retired at age 25. You moved to Japan. You moved to a Thai island. There you lost everything. And eventually, somehow, despite all of that, you became one of the most followed economists today. So what happened there?
If the system limps along for 20 or 30 or 50 years, and then it collapses, then I think we just go to directly to Bitcoin. Bitcoin is far more efficient. You don't have that backing problem. You don't have that sovereign exposure. The people who are going to benefit are going to be the blue collars. They're going to go from $9 painting a house to $200 painting a house to $3,000 painting a house. You're going to make six figures at Starbucks.
Last one. AI is a net positive for jobs, or AI is net negative for jobs?
In the long run, massively positive.
Criticized by PAT. Hey, Peter, so good to see you and to have you here. I've been looking forward to doing this for a while now, so very happy it's happening. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward.
All right, very good. So, Peter, let's get started with how it all started. So it looks like you retired at age 25. You moved to Japan. You moved to a Thai island. There you lost everything. And eventually, somehow, despite all of that, you became one of the most followed economists today. So what happened there?
So back in the mid-1990s, that was the middle of the dot-com boom. And I read an interview with Paul Krugman where he said that the internet wasn't going to amount to much because we were going to run out of things to say. We were going to get sick of sharing cat photos, and then the internet would end up having the influence of the fax machine. And I thought, that is so stupid. And I thought, okay, Paul Krugman, whatever you think about his politics, he's clearly a high IQ person.
Yes.
He's got a Nobel Prize. He's not that dumb.
A great math mind.
Yeah, so I thought, if Paul Krugman is that stupid on the internet, then there's going to be a lot of other people who are that stupid. And a lot of those people are going to be running a lot of money. And that money right now is not in the internet, but it's coming. So as soon as I read that, I sold everything I had and I bought, like, there was only one internet stock you could buy at that time, which was Yahoo. So I put everything in Yahoo at $60. All my friends told me I'm an idiot, because it was already a bubble, right? You know, it started at whatever, $10 or 20 bucks, and it was 60. Mm-hmm. So I said, no. So I put everything in Yahoo, and it didn't do anything for about a year. This is 97 maybe, 96. And so it didn't do anything for a little while. And then you had the Asian financial crisis. Everything crashed. All the growth stocks crashed. Internet crashed. Everybody said, the internet's over. It's a fad. Nobody can make any money on it. Nobody's going to buy anything online because they don't trust you. And I thought, this is all stupid, just wait and see. And, you know, of course it took off and Yahoo split adjusted, went to 1500 or something. So I was a millionaire at 25. And so I figured, okay, you know, the trick in life is that when you're young, you have a lot of time and energy, but you don't have any money. And then when you're older, you got plenty of money, but you don't have any time, you don't have any energy, you're old, you don't want to go backpacking and taking ferries in, you know, Indonesia or something when you're 60. So I figured, okay, let me go ahead and do that now, get all that out of my system. So I went backpacking it turned out to be about 4 years. But anyway, I went backpacking. And at one point I was on a Thai island. You know, every time stocks would go down, I would get nervous and I would sell some of it. And then it would go up again and then I would buy back in. And I went back and tallied up the losses. And I said, you know, I'd have enough to run for Senate if I didn't do things like that. So let me, you know, like Jason tying himself to the mast in the Argonauts, I figured, all right, let me get off the grid so I can't sell stuff. And then if it goes down, you know, I don't even notice. And so I moved to this island in Thailand, Koh Phangan, and I learned Muay Thai, which was horrible. The first like month, they make you kick wooden logs to condition yourself. So you kick them and you hit them with your forearm. So you are, first you're covered in bruises and then you're covered in blood. It was absolutely brutal. But at any rate, so I went and did that. And I came, you know, I took a speedboat back to check in on my family, let them know I was alive. And then I log into the stocks and I see that, you know, everything is like, you know, four times lower. And I thought, oh, this is going to be great. There must have been a stock split. Back then, every time you got a stock split, you got paid, you know, they would go up like 20%. And so I said, this is going to be good. And then it turned out, no, it was not a stock split. Actually, the stock I lost the most on was MicroStrategy.
Oh,
which is now famous because of the Bitcoin stuff. But anyway, yeah. Back then, you know, they'd soared in 2000, and it dropped like, I don't know, 85-90%. So anyway, I wiped out. I had maybe like 40 grand left, which is not enough to retire on even in Thailand. And so I had to go find a way to make money. I'd gone to high school in Japan, so I speak Japanese. So I figured, you know, I'm already out in Asia, so let me go to Japan, try and figure out what's the next step. So I went there, bartended for a while, and then got a series of jobs and kind of worked my way up so that I was international marketing lead for Takara Toys, which is one of the biggest toy companies in Japan. Now it's Tomy Takara, and they make the Transformers. But anyway, so then I got to there and then went back to get my PhD and went into being a professor in Taiwan, of all places. So bopped around a lot. But yeah, that's kind of the story on the investment. And it's funny because in the whole crypto thing over the past 10 years, it's been very, very similar, right? There's a lot of guys, they're almost all guys. Yeah. There's a lot of guys who went through that exact situation, right? They, you know, goofed around with some meme coin, made, you know, whatever, $20 million, went out, cruised the world, did whatever one does at 25 with that much money. And then, you know, a lot of them also wiped out. So it's, you know, I've got company at this point.
I know quite a few of those. And yeah, and talking about Japan and Taiwan, yeah, it seems like you spent 10 years roughly between the two yep. countries. So yeah. Given how much those two countries have gone through really incredible economic transformations, what would you say that you have learned from that, from that change?
You learn a ton. For one thing, they're fascinating because in many ways, they're a model, I think, for Westerners. They have a lot of the valuable things that we've lost. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the U.S., for example, used to be a much higher trust society. It still is if you go to rural areas. We lived in Alabama for a while, and the biggest risk in Alabama is that if you stop your car on the side of the road, people will pull over to ask if you're okay and if there's anything they can do.
Right.
Like when we lived there, I would like pull over to check a map. And I mean, within about 10 seconds, somebody would pull over to ask me if everything's okay. And I'd be like, yep, just fine, checking a map. And then like 20 seconds later, somebody else pulls up. It's ridiculous. So I learned, yeah, so like if you're going to pull over in Alabama, you got to pull over like in a 7-Eleven, okay? Because otherwise everybody's going to jump out and try to help you. It's really striking. So, and you know, in Japan and Taiwan, in many ways, they've kept that level of social trust. There is essentially zero crime in these places. Nobody was even rude to me. We were in Taiwan for about 5 years. Nobody was rude to me. I mean, never. Nothing that, you know, never did you remotely feel exposed. You know, young women would walk around at 3 a.m. in the nightclub district in miniskirts, just with zero fear. There's a lot of things there that I think are good models. Families are much stronger. People stay married. Children take care of their parents. There's just a lot of aspects that I think we can look up to. Another thing that, you know, kind of an impression it left me with is in regards to China, which is that, you know, when I look at the Taiwanese people who are culturally Chinese, they are very smart. They're much smarter than the average American. It is striking. Mm-hmm. They're very hardworking. They're very warm, friendly. You know, we used to joke that if Japan and Mexico had a baby, it would be Taiwan.
Oh,
just really an amazing culture. And so I think one of the things it left me with is that, number one, you know, I think a lot of Americans dismiss the idea that China is going to displace us as, you know, sort of the most dynamic economy in the world. Mm-hmm. I think people are underestimating Chinese. It's a very, very impressive culture. The government does a lot of things wrong, but it also does a lot of things smarter than our own government does. Washington is pretty bad at running a country. And then it's also influenced me just in terms of certain policies. You know, for example, we're having this the immigration debate in the U.S. Yeah. We're having the tariffs debate. in a number of ways, places like Taiwan and Japan are much more nationalistic than even the West, even than Trump. They're very nationalistic, but it's not a hostile kind of nationalism. It's not a, we're going to, you know, run you down and burn your house. It's more like they're deeply proud of their culture. Right. But they also don't want to dilute it. You know, they don't want mass migration. They don't want to lose what's in their culture, which I have deep respect for. I think every country in the world should do that. Every country in the world traditionally does do that. Nationalism is, you know, I think one of the great unifiers of a community. And I would count myself as a nationalist, and I'm a nationalist for all countries. You know, I think Canadians should be Canada first, Taiwanese should be Taiwan first. I'm very sympathetic to the sort of spirit that nationalism creates among a people. It unites them. It makes people want to pick up trash on the street. It makes people want to invest time in making the schools better in their communities. And it's a very, very positive force.
The Magad Weed Show is brought to you by Skinny Skin. Skinny Skin is a premium assortment of skin and lip therapy products manufactured with natural ingredients originated in Africa. I founded Skinny Skin in an effort to create jobs, prosperity, and provide a greater sense of dignity for my beloved Senegal. Skinny Skin is an African product made in Africa by Africans, bringing money and capital into African economies through value creation. Purchasing African products made in Africa by Africans is what Africa needs to thrive. Visit skinnyskin.com and discover a product.
You know, it is oftentimes one of the arguments that I bring up to my fellow African people who right away, they want to see racism in any, you know, any person's like, oh, I like my culture. I'm like, just put yourself back in the same shoes. What, how would you feel if your country X would be, you know, and then all of a sudden be like, oh, I guess I never thought about it. Well, there you go. So,
oh, and you see it very strongly. You know, if you're talking about Zimbabwe migrants in South Africa.
Yeah. I know.
Yeah, I know. I mean, Africa is as nationalistic as anywhere in the world.
I know. No, that's very interesting. And so going back to when you were talking about the economy. So, and coming closer now to the U.S., going back, you know, when Trump got elected, many experts said that there was going to be a crash, right? So, and with the tariffs, they also said that it would cause hyperinflation. But we have seen that the economy has been growing while inflation is staying low. Why do you think the so-called experts are always getting it so wrong?
Yeah, well, I think they're biased. Part of the reason they're biased is because they're paid to be, right? So the, you know, the general way that the parties break down pretty much in every country is that you have one party that represents the government, the sort of the in-group, the deep state, government-linked organizations, unions, often the banking system, which, you know, tends to cooperate with government so it can get crony regulation and banned competition. So you have all these industries and all of this money that is tied in with the government. And so you have one party that represents that, so call it the in party, and then you'll tend to have an out party. Mm-hmm. And the out party appeals to people who want to be left alone, right? So that tends to be small business, for example, right? Small business tends to lose more from a big government. Big business tends to love big government because they use it. Right. They can write big checks and they can bribe senators and they can make the government do things for them, give them money. If you look at Wall Street, that's the perfect example, or healthcare, for example, pharmaceuticals. So you're always going to have this in-group, out-group. And universities were one of the main focus areas for socialists. Right. They were very explicit about this. In the 1800s, it was called Fabian socialism. Fabian was a Roman general who fought through wars of attrition. And the idea was very, very gradually. You don't fight one big battle. You do it step by step by step through attrition. The idea was to impose socialism not through the Great Revolution, but through piece by piece capturing the commanding heights of the culture. And one of the most important is media. And the other one is education. Because if you can run voters through 12 years of brainwashing, it becomes very, very easy to, you know, get them to vote for life, for big government. And indeed, you see that in the U.S. where, you know, you have so-called left-wingers. And they're funny, you know, if you look at sort of the stereotypical Antifa protester, you know, sort of the blue-haired with lots of face piercings, these are inherently anti-authoritarian people, I don't think they're faking it. I think they genuinely reject authority. They hate the man. And it's weird that they've been so brainwashed that they are the foot soldiers for the man. Yeah. Right? Yeah. To me, it's just incredible. But that's the magic of education. The socialists were very, very successful at capturing that. And so professors, you know, if you look at elite departments, you know, like Ivy League departments, sometimes you don't have any conservative or libertarian at all.
Yeah.
So you've got maybe, you know, 20% of the country is deep progressive and 100% or 95% of the Yale faculty will be that group. Moreover, the reason why 20% of the country is, you know, wacko progressive is because of that 100%. Like in a state of nature, what percent of people actually believe that men and women are fake? It's a crazy belief. You know, Matt Walsh had his movie, What is a Woman, I think?
Yes.
And he went to Kenya.
Yeah, I remember the Kenya, right? Yeah, when he went to the Kenya.
Yeah, exactly. And he asked people, you know, what is a woman? And they literally thought either he was joking or he was stupid. Yeah. It's an incoherent question to normal humans. You have to be brainwashed for 12 years to believe that kind of thing, or to believe that a government is good at, you know, running an economy, or to believe that a central bank is anything but a counterfeiting machine. So you have this brainwashing industrial complex, and the professors are the center of that. Mm-hmm. Right. Before the government got involved in education, right, if you look back through history, what do professors do? Well, the closest analog is like a street preacher or like philosophers who would literally walk around door to door. Socrates would preach in the street and passed out a hat for collections. Okay. In a normal functioning economy outside the government, you don't have professors.
Yeah.
Right. The closest thing you have is, you know, you have like research or, you know, like AT&T labs where they research light bulbs. Okay. Yes, you have that. You have corporate R&D. You don't have universities in state nature. That is a government creation. And so it would be shocking if they were anti-government. I mean, these people, the whole reason that professors make, you know, $500,000 a year, right, and get to lord it over the plebs, the whole, right, reason they don't have to, you know, they're not street preachers handing, you know, trying to ask for donations, the whole reason is because of the government. So, of course, they are very hostile to the out party. And Donald Trump is the ultimate out party. Right. He is Caesar. He is opposed to the patricians. He hates the system. He hates the deep state. So, yeah, absolutely. They despise him, which means that despite all the degrees and the Nobel Prizes, they will believe anything if it's anti-Trump.
Interesting. And when you were talking about academia and media being the, you know, where all of this has been happening, I would also add Hollywood, which keeps people in a constant state.
Absolutely.
You know, yep. So that whole thing is deeply, deeply troubling. You know, Congress had a chance to cut $1.5 trillion in waste, and yet they have not done anything. And I know that you've been talking about it, how for decades, you know, we've been promised that things would change, but it's not happening. So what do you think it's going to take for government to get smaller? I mean, at this point, I'm just wondering, is it even possible at this point, or have we gone too far, or... what do you think it's going to take?
Yeah, so historically, you know, you have two ways to fix it. One of them is to fix it halfway and buy some more time. So let's call that Reagan. Okay, so, you know, the U.S. fiscal situation in the 1970s was dire. We had stagflation. The economy was stagnant. We had rising government spending, double-digit inflation. Things were looking very bad. A lot of people were very hopeless in the 1970s. And then Ronald Reagan came in and he fixed a lot of these things. So he reduced taxes, he improved regulations, the government got out of the way on a lot of things, and then we had pretty fast growth. And if you look at economic growth since the 1980s, it has been fast enough that, you know, people in the 70s thought that the collapse was imminent. I think the Reagan Revolution and then Bill Clinton, to his credit, more or less continued it. It bought us a number of decades. Right. Things started getting bad again after the 2008 crisis. Trump came in, same deal, cut taxes, cut regulations. Now, spending kept growing. But the thing is that we've been lucky enough to have presidents who were, it's not that they helped the economy, but they reduced the burden that the government puts on the economy enough that the economy has been able to outgrow all of the spending. So, you know, if you are a betting man, then I think that's probably the safe assumption going forward is that the government will continue spending more. However, you know, because we still do have elections, however imperfect, governments have not completely destroyed the economy. And so it's quite likely that the economic growth keeps up enough that we don't get the pitchforks. The alternative and how it gets fixed in most countries, especially countries that are not democratic, is that you keep going or accelerating until you get the crash. And then the crash fixes it. So call that the Soviet solution, right? Mm-hmm. The thing collapses and overnight you just throw out the entire system. So like Tuesday afternoon, everybody in the Soviet Union was a Marxist and believed that they were winning. Thursday morning, nobody had ever been a Marxist. Nobody believes that crazy talk, right? So you just throw out the entire system. So that's really the question ongoing is, are there enough sort of controls or countervailing movements in the U.S., I guess basically are markets free enough that the U.S. can continue growing, keeping up with the increase in government spending? Or if we break that system, then probably it gets really bad really fast, and then we get a Soviet-style reset. And, you know, resets in the Soviet Union was relatively bloodless. In most countries, it tends not to be bloodless. So you're not necessarily rooting for that. Mm-hmm. You know, there is a portion, especially of young American men who might be right-leaning or libertarian-leaning, who, what do they call them, black pills, right, where they are sort of rooting for a collapse because they want this great reset. Job. I think the risk on that is that, you know, there's about 200 countries in the world. Roughly 199 of them have a garbage socialist constitution, and one of them has a super-based libertarian. Like, the U.S. Constitution was written by people who detested government. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's shocking how good it is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, currently, it's not functionally that good because of the so-called Constitution in Exile. Basically, during FDR, the Supreme Court pretended that what he was doing was constitutional. It's actually not. The 10th Amendment says that, you know, anything not listed in the Constitution, it's not allowed, federal government's not allowed to do. Almost everything the federal government is doing is not in the Constitution, so it is unconstitutional. The Supreme Court has not grown a pair to strike that down yet. But the point is that if we do the great black pill reset, my concern is that we're going to come out of it with some... with like Canada, basically, where, you know, we don't have the constitutional safeguards to protect liberty. So I would much rather focus on that very small piece there, which is that, you know, we need about two or three Supreme Court justices who can actually read the 10th Amendment, and that's how you get revolution. So I'm not a huge fan of the black pill. I'd rather limp along, but mm-hmm. there are a lot of people who, you know, if you say, you know, careful guys, let's not break it, especially young men, right? Young men by nature want to break it. This is how progress, you know, happens. It's also how destruction happens. So it's a wonderful servant and a terrible master.
We gotta call what I call testosterone poisoning. We got to thank it in some places. I'm being facetious.
Like the reason why we are not, you know, serfs and slaves to kings is because young men, you know, we're reckless enough to say, hell no. So, I mean, it's not a bad thing, but I'm saying that in the specific context of the U.S., we have this beautiful constitution that I think it's extremely important that we don't break that.
Yeah, no, interesting. And so going back, going to the tariffs. So I know that in principles, you've been against tariffs, yet you've been defending Trump's tariffs, because you've been saying that, hey, look, countries are responding by lowering their tariffs. So at this point, my question for you is, like, which is it, Peter? Yeah. Are you against tariffs in principle, or the end justifies the means?
Yeah, so tariffs on their own are a tax. They're essentially a sales tax. It's a funny one because it only hits some things, stuff produced by foreigners. So on their own, they're bad, just like any tax is bad. And the question is, are you doing anything useful with those tariffs? Mm-hmm. And so that's where I've been tolerant of Trump's tariffs, because he's been pushing two things. One of them is for other countries to remove their barriers on U.S. goods. And broadly speaking, every other country in the world has much more barriers against the U.S. This is weird, right? When you're the Roman Empire, you're supposed to take advantage of small countries, right? Like, why the U.S. gets shafted on everything is weird. But, you know, probably the reason is because the deep state profits from those kinds of deals. But at any rate, the fact is almost every country takes advantage of the U.S. when given, you know, the U.S. is one third of the world economy. It's big. So the U.S. should be taking advantage of other countries. I mean, that's just pure fairness. The other aspect, of course, is that, you know, because the U.S. is a third of the world economy, if you use tariffs as a stick to force countries to relocate factories in your country, it will work. This is what China has done for 40 years. It has worked spectacularly well. You know, all of the economists who are laughing at tariffs, okay, talk to China, right? So you're telling me that, you know, China is an idiot for doing its tariffs? You know, China is fools for fighting to protect the tariffs? It's been massively successful because what China has done is it now has the leading manufacturing industry in almost everything in the world. It's a couple of tiny sectors like semiconductors that it doesn't dominate, but almost all of manufacturing, it is now located to China, and it did that using tariffs. So I think tariffs can work. The trick on a tariff is this. If you put a tariff in and you do not improve the business environment in your country, then it's going to fail.
That's
okay, so this is the standard pattern in most of Africa, yeah. In places like Brazil. They'll put a tariff in, but they will not do anything to, you know, you need roads, you need electricity that doesn't shut off to have a factory. You need low regulations. African countries are astounding. I think Uganda has the longest regulatory code in the world. If regulations could make you rich, Uganda would be like, right? It's astounding how much regulation is in Africa. The taxes off, you know, if your taxes are high, if it's capricious, if somebody in government doesn't like you, then they can take your business. So property rights. So all of these things matter. If you don't fix those and you put tariffs on, that's just, you're making it worse. Right. You're punishing your own people. Exactly. So you have to pair the tariffs with genuine improvements to the business environment. Now, that's what China did, right? China had, in its high growth period, it had relatively low taxes. It had very, very reasonable regulation. And it spent a lot of money on infrastructure, so roads, ports. And so that's why the Chinese tariffs were extremely successful. Now, Trump has been trying to do that. The Big Beautiful Bill was very good on taxes. They cut, what do they have? The bonus depreciation, which is a very big deal. That means companies can write off. They can build a factory and they can write off the entire cost of the factory in their tax. It's a very big deal if you are a business. There's a lot of good things in there. He's been trying to reduce regulation. So the Trump package, as he's got it planned out, is perfect. You use the tariffs, you know, to pressure other countries to entice them to produce in your country. And at the same time, you cut taxes and regulation. So for example, that's very successful right now against Europe. So you've got a lot of car companies in Germany. They're facing electric costs that are 2 to 3 times higher because Europe smashed all its you know, coal plants. They're facing ridiculous regulation, taxes. So those companies are moving anyway. They're almost looking for an excuse to move to the US so they can tell their shareholders, or they can tell the press back in Germany. They can tell the politicians who might otherwise punish them. They can say, no, no, look, we would love to stay in Germany. We love Germany. We love it here, the Bratwurst. But we've got to go to the U.S. because of the tariff. So in that case, that's like textbook. That's perfect. Now, Chinese companies don't necessarily want to move, or Korean or Taiwanese or Japan, because the business environment is pretty good over there. In many cases, it's better than it is in the U.S. You have lower regulation, lower taxes, better infrastructure. So they're not necessarily moving, you know, as like a pull factor because Trump made it attractive to produce in the U.S. They're moving because of the tariffs. But you put those together, and broadly speaking, in theory, tariffs are terrible. They're a tax. All taxes are bad, always and everywhere. But in this case, I think Trump, so long as he keeps up with the tax cuts and the regulatory cuts, if you pair those with tariffs, I think it's pretty good.
Got it. Speaking of tax cuts, you said that removing taxes for small businesses will help grow jobs at a rate of 5 to 10 times, you know, more than cutting taxes for big corporations. I mean, Peter, that's a big number. Why do you think no one is listening to this?
I think a lot of people are. I mean, broadly speaking, small business tends to be a lot more sympathetic. If I'm trying to get people, like if I'm trying to make a tax cut look bad, then I'm going to focus on the impact on big business, right? If I want to make it look good, I'm going to talk about small business. People in general like small business. They trust it. And part of the reason is that small business is not corrupt like big businesses, yeah. Right? Small business, it won't intimidate you with lawyers. It won't buy laws. So I think that people are listening. In general, in the U.S., and I think in most countries, the tax system tends to benefit small businesses, the regulatory system for sure. There's a lot of regulations that don't kick in until you have 20 or 50 employees. So there are a lot of ways that we are benefiting small business. I think we need to do that a lot more for exactly that reason. Small businesses tend to be much less capital intensive, meaning that they tend to employ a lot more people than a large business. So about 5 to 10 times more. And these are, you know, service businesses, restaurants, you know, a lot of it's personal service, business services. These tend to be much more job intensive per dollar than big businesses.
Very interesting. So now I want to move now into more like the money issue. You're notorious for having said that the Fed has gone rogue. What has the Fed done so wrong? And why? And so for someone who is not following the Fed every day and doesn't even, they hear about it, but they don't really know what's going on. Can you please help educate, you know, the audience who's listening on this? What's going on?
Sure. So the Federal Reserve is a central bank. And what a central bank is essentially a deal where commercial banks, like Citibank, they get together and create a cartel where they agree that we can only print money so fast. They are counterfeiting, but we can only print money so fast. Now, if they do that themselves, it looks bad. And so they'll try to create some government agency to print the money for them. And then the other part of the deal is that those banks want to take that money. They want to lend it out. If they get into trouble, they go bankrupt because they push too much risk, then they want somebody to bail them out. Okay, so fundamentally, a central bank does two things. It prints money, creates money. So it pours water into the wine of the dollars that you had to actually work for. Okay, so it dilutes those. It effectively steals those and hands those to banks. And the other thing it does is it's a permanent bailout machine. The problem is that if you have a bailout machine, so if you tell a bunch of gamblers, you put a bunch of guys in a bus and you drive over to Las Vegas and you say, you guys can gamble. Here's the deal. If you win, you keep it. If you lose, just come to me and I'll cover it. Okay, what do you think is going to happen? They're going to take real big bets. That's because right. If they lose, you're going to cover it. If they win, they get to keep it. Correct. So this is what central banks, that's what the bailout function, the so-called lender of last resort is what it's called in central banking. And they put it on a pedestal like it's, you know, like worship it. They you know, put offerings before it every morning. That's very important to them. And what that does is it creates this permanent bailout machine. And the way that banks respond to that is by being permanently risky. So you have financial crisis after financial crisis. You have the inflation because they're printing the money. So you get inflation. And then when the inflation gets out of hand, the central bank raises interest rates. So it makes it more expensive to borrow money. That hits mortgages. It hits business lending. That tends to crash the economy into recession. So you end up getting this boom-bust cycle where you get inflation, recession, financial crash. Inflation, recession, financial crash, all punctuated with bailouts. You know, so the one in 2008, about $1.8 trillion. We've got another one brewing. Well, we had one in 2023 where a bunch of banks collapsed, including Silicon Valley Bank. That one was automatically bailed out. Wall Street was very clever. They don't have to ask for the bailout anymore. It's just automatic. So the Fed basically told banks, don't worry. We know you have all these bad loans, but just put some fictitious number on it. Call it whatever you like. Mark, what is it? Mark to model, not mark to market. So they said, just put a number on it and we'll lend you however much you want based on that. So I tried that at the bank, didn't work. Okay, the rest of us can't do that. These are privileges that bankers have. So the end result is central banking in general. This is why people hate central banking so much. I think to outsiders, it sounds crazy. Like, why are you so obsessed with the Fed? Okay, that's the reason why, is because a central bank is an inflation machine, it's a recession or depression machine, and it's a bank bailout machine. This is why we don't like it in general. So having said, all right, why is the Fed rogue at the moment? It's essentially always rogue. The general pattern since the Fed was started in 1913, right before World War I, in fact, World War I partly happened because we had a Fed. Fed could cut the checks. It started going rogue in its most recent episode, starting with COVID, right? So if you take what happened in COVID with the government lockdowns, so imagine your government early in COVID, and you say, we have this terrible respiratory illness. It has twice the death rate of the flu. So we have to stop it somehow. Okay. Okay. And then you have a junior bureaucrat who says, hey, wait, I got a great idea. Let's close down the entire economy. Tax revenue will plunge. It'll plunge by half. That's what happened in Canada when they first did it. Tax revenue will plunge by half, but that's okay because we can just fire all the federal workers. All right. So you're done here at Government Incorporated, right? You're going to get exiled out to Guam. Your career is over because we're not laying off half the federal workers. We're not, you know, stopping the bailouts to Wall Street. We're not stopping the corporate crony capitalism going out to big business. No, we're not doing any of that. Mm-hmm. However, now you have a central bank. What you can do with a central bank is you can print unlimited amounts of money. It's called quantitative easing. Essentially, they sit in the basement, they type a bunch of zeros on an Excel sheet, they say, voila, this is money. And then they go out and spend that money to buy stuff. The money that that effectively creates the money. All those trillions of dollars are now flooding out the economy, competing with your dollars. And what happened in COVID is that they used central banks to buy the lockdowns. The only reason that we could have lockdowns is because the central banks financed it. But of course, if you print that much money, you're going to create massive inflation. That's exactly what happened, the Bidenflation. So prices went up, depending how you count it, 20%, 40%. So in order to stop that, they did what they always do, going way back to the beginning of central banking. They had to stomp on the brakes, jack up the interest rates, the mortgage rates, and that broke. It broke, you know, jobs. It broke the housing market in the U.S., for example, is completely frozen. And so that's where we are today, where they're sort of punishing Trump. We still have rates that are higher relative to where they've been the past 40 years. Rates are still high. They're about 1% above so-called R star, which is sort of the neutral rate of rates. So interest rates are too high. Lending is too expensive. That's hitting credit cards. It's hitting mortgage rates. It's raising expenses for families. And they're doing all that because they were fighting the inflation that they had caused under Biden, which was going away at least until the war. We'll see what happens with the war, but at the moment, it looks like the war is now increasing interest rates, and so we're going to have, it's increasing inflation rather. So it looks like we're going to have problems.
Yeah, inflation is definitely going up right now.
Yeah.
So, Peter, you are a Bitcoin guy. We know that. So am I. And in your case, and I agree with it, you said that you're, I guess, for Bitcoin because it cuts the government's ability to print more money, and it also cuts the government's ability to destroy people's savings. Yet at the same time, we all know very smart people, and you and I were joking about Peter Schiff earlier, but both you and I, we know very smart people who still want to, you know, view Bitcoin as a speculation. So how do you explain this to people?
So Peter Schiff specifically, I think the issue there is simply that he sells gold. That's his business. And the man who sells gold is going to make fun of Bitcoin. And the man who sells Bitcoin is going to make fun of gold. And why do I think that? Because we have a natural experiment, which is that there's another competitor to gold that he does not trash talk, which is silver. So he spends no time beating up on silver. He spends no time complaining about silver. But he spends a lot of time complaining about Bitcoin. So this makes me think, okay, no, this is about what Peter sells for a living. Now, having said, if we zoom out, you know, so gold and Bitcoin, I think the distinction, so I love them both. I love silver as well. I love anything hard that stands some chance of being money. So I do love them all. I think that what makes Bitcoin unique and interesting is that historically, the cycle with gold has been governments get a hold of the money, they inflate, they collapse the economy, and at that point, everybody returns to hard money. So in most of history, that's gold. They go to gold, and then government immediately gets to work trying to capture it again. And gold is very easy to capture because the problem is you can't base a monetary system on hidden gold. Mm-hmm. Okay, you can't tell everybody, okay, one option is that you can trade gold coins, but that's going to be difficult with, you know, paying your Netflix bill. So generally, an efficient monetary system is going to have some kind of tokenization, whether it's, you know, a paper dollar or an actual token. And then it's going to have some banking asset that's held somewhere. Okay, that's sort of the efficient way to do a gold-based system. So now you can, you know, transmit gold tokens over the internet called dollars. You can do it in person and so on. Now, the problem is if you do that, you tell people, okay, my, you know, dollar is backed by gold, but I can't tell you where the gold is. It's hidden. Okay, you can't do that, right? You have to tell people. You have to be like, the gold is at this address. Here's a camera. Here's the auditor. We've, you know, assayed it. All right. Once you do that, it's very easy for government to come and visit you. And they're going to offer opinions about what you should do with this gold. For example, you should lend it to them. And then instead, you should have an IOU in its place. Right. So throughout history, you have this constant arms battle between gold and between the government who's capturing the gold. And the irony is that gold's fundamental weakness is that it is physical. Right. So gold bugs, they say the reason why Bitcoin is trash and gold is king is because you can drop it on your foot. You can do stuff with it. You can hold it. It's real. Okay. But that's also the fundamental flaw, right? Because that means that either it's a very poor medium of exchange. It's hard to buy stuff on Amazon, sending the gold. Or, I mean, you know, you got to trust somebody if you mail it. So you'd actually have to hand carry it over to them. They'd have to assay it on the spot. Right. So so because of that, what excites me about Bitcoin is that it breaks that cycle. So no longer do you have these sort of magnified generational boom bust where you get the inflation and then the super crash, then the capture gold, launch the inflation again, the super crash over and over and over, which is what history's been. Instead, you finally break it. Now, in order to get to Bitcoin or gold, you've got to have a monetary collapse, right? If things limp along, you know what I was saying earlier, the Reagan solution versus the Soviet solution, you got to go Soviet in order to get to either gold or Bitcoin because there's so much, you know, established base using dollars. There's a lot of companies that are obviously, they want to hold on to dollars. Partly that's banks, partly it's just regular companies, right? We saw when El Salvador allowed companies to take Bitcoin as a means of payment, almost nobody did because you've got accounting systems and, yeah, there's economies of scale to using QuickBooks with dollars. And yeah, there's just a lot of synergies. So it won't, I think, happen sort of organically. I think what does happen organically is lifeboats, right? So individuals realize the nature of central banking, why fiat currencies are a poor investment, and then they shift their resources into stores of value. So that without a doubt happens. But in terms of changing the entire system, that will not happen organically. You need some kind of crisis. And then the question is, so when that crisis happens, do we go to gold or do we go to Bitcoin? And I think that question is timing. So if the system is going to break in the next 10 years, then almost certainly we go to gold. And the reason is that there are actually people with living memory of the 1970s when the financial system was still working on gold. Switzerland had gold content to its currency until I think the 1990s, right? So there are people with actual memory of how a gold-backed system worked. Meanwhile, Bitcoiners tend to be under 40. They're not influential yet. Okay, so if it happens in the next 10 years, I think almost certainly we go to gold. Once you go to gold, I think the sort of cannibalization by Bitcoin accelerates because it is conceptually so much closer to gold. On the other hand, if the system limps along for 20 or 30 or 50 years, and then it collapses, then I think we just go to directly to Bitcoin. Bitcoin is far more efficient. You don't have that backing problem. You don't have that sovereign exposure. It's a just incredibly efficient system. There was a news story a couple of years ago where the Dutch central bank wanted to move, I don't remember the numbers, it was something like $1 billion worth of gold. And it took them something like 6 months. And I think the move cost something like $1.5 million. Like, think about it, moving that much gold, right? I mean, you got to have a column of armed guards.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
It's no joke. No. You can move $1 billion of Bitcoin for, what are fees right now? I don't know, a dollar? I mean, it is shocking. Yeah, it's just absolutely shocking how much more efficient it is. Bitcoin at this point has lower inflation than gold. I think you might know better, but given the halving, I think we're at about 0.5% a year on Bitcoin, whereas gold has been at about 1.5% forever. In other words, of all the gold that exists or that is in circulation. 1.5% is mined every year. I think Bitcoin is fundamentally superior. It's just a question of how many people are familiar with it when that Soviet moment hits.
That's a very good point, and I agree with that. You were talking about efficiency earlier, so now I want to take us to one of my favorite guys, Milei. So here's Milei, whom I know you've covered out of Argentina. And he came, he deregulated. And so where we had deficits, now we have surplus. You know, inflation, he's completely, you know, vanquishing it at the moment. So something seems to really be working, right? But at the same time, I want to believe that it's replicable, right? I'm out there always talking about how, you know, with deregulation and economic freedom and, you know, we can all nations could get there. So do you think it's as replicable, or Milei and what he did in Argentina is replicable? Or do you think there's something specific to Argentina and or Milei himself for what has happened?
I think it's absolutely replicable. The question is always the political constraints in each country. So I don't think there's any kind of cultural or geographic or any kind of that barrier, but there are absolutely political constraints. So if you look at, you know, when he first took office, he had, I think, 1 out of 7 seats in Congress. And Argentina has a fairly strong president, but, you know, it's maybe comparable to the U.S., but he can't do everything on his own. And so he got blocked on a lot of the big moves by the opposition in Congress. So that was why, for example, he couldn't completely get rid of inflation. It was why he couldn't fix the labor market early on. There were a number of big reforms that he wanted. Now, he then went through midterm elections and he won. I think he might have 60% of the seats at this point. So now he does have control and now he's able to put a lot of that stuff through. But the opposition, for example, you know, one of his big campaign promises was to either abolish the central bank, just replace it with dollarization. So using the dollar as kind of a gold standard, which for Argentina, a dollar would be relatively a gold standard. And, you know, that's something that El Salvador did, for example. So he had talked about that during the campaign, but he was not able to do that because he didn't have the seats in Congress. So now he's able to do a lot more. Now, if we look at other countries, you know, we can sort of drill in case by case, like which countries are relatively easy to change. The U.S. is actually, well, okay, we start with who's easy. Europe is surprisingly easy. So most countries in Europe have a simple parliamentarian system where if you win 51% of the seats, you can make everybody stand on their head. So that's one of the reasons why I think that Europe's going to be interesting. It's trending populist. It's trending nationalist. The political parties in Europe have generally reacted by forming a cartel to shut out the populists. So you have these so-called grand coalitions. Germany is an example where effectively, like, the Democrats and the Republicans are ruling together. Now, if you do that, you are going to be stagnant, right? Because the only policy, I mean, that is the uniparty. That is literally the uniparty running the country. Yeah. And, you know, Germany's in bad shape. Like, Europe in general right now is sort of holding on to each other, drowning, because the dominant political organization in Europe is becoming these grand coalitions of left and right against the populists. That's eventually going to break through because the grand coalitions are so bad that the populists are going to keep getting bigger and bigger. A lot of the populists are new to politics. They're going to do stupid stuff. You've already seen a number of things. You know, they're going to say something insensitive, or they're just going to be bad at governing. There's going to be ups and downs. But if you sort of zoom out and look at the big trend here, when you're at the stage where the entire establishment has to cling to each other for survival, you're counting down the days. And when the populists do take power in Europe, because of those parliamentary systems, I think Europe is going to change very, very fast. You know, Europe famously dramatically out-socialisted America, right? So if you look back at the early 1900s, a lot of people thought that America was going to go socialist first because that was really where the socialist movements were. But Europe ended up going much, much faster. And the reason is that the U.S. has intentionally, it has a lot of inertia built into the system. So the U.S. moves very, very slowly. So Europe's pendulum swings much further than America. Now, at the moment, that means that Europe is far more woke than America. So it's arresting people for Facebook tweets, doing, you know, sort of outwoking America, which America invented woke, so that must be humiliating for the blue hairs. But at any rate, Europe has outwoked America. when it swings back, I think it's going to shock people. It's going to be much, much more nationalist and more populist than Trump. America itself, I think, you know, because it has all that institutional inertia, I think it's going to move very frustratingly slow for America. There's a lot of Americans who constantly feel like we need a revolution because the system changes so frustratingly slow. So it's got elements to it. For example, the judiciary is independent in the U.S. That's not actually part of the Constitution. Okay, under the Constitution, the Supreme Court does not get to tell the government what to do. Individual states get to decide whether something is unconstitutional. So that's been a perversion. That was Marbury v. Madison. Rothbard has written about this. He thinks the Supreme Court has grown into a monster. But at any rate, currently in the U.S. political system, everybody pretends that the Supreme Court is boss. You also have something called the filibuster, where any kind of important laws that you want to pass need the uniparty. So in a sense, the U.S. does have that sort of grand coalition that they have in Europe, at least Congress. And that's part of the reason why you see Trump and Congress behaving so differently, right? So whether it's Democrats or Republicans, everybody in America hates Congress. Congress's approval rating going on decades is typically about 20%, which is roughly dysentery. But it's awful, right? Like, nobody ever likes Congress. And that is the exact reason. Because of the filibuster, which is a requirement that 60% of senators have to vote for something, and almost never does one party own 60% of seats. So because of that system, the U.S. Congress tends to be completely uniparty. And so if you get anything interesting happening in the U.S., it's always the president that does that. We've had this trend where the U.S. presidency gets stronger and stronger. It's called the imperial presidency. But that's where a lot of the sort of, that's where the battle lines are, where they've been for about 50 years because of that.
Yeah.
So wrapping it all up, right, I think U.S. changes slower than people expect. Europe changes faster than people expect. The rest of the world, I think, largely depends whether they have a British-derived parliamentary system. So were they a former British colony, in which case they'll tend to move fast. If they don't, if they have a more French-derived or some other country, then they're probably going to move relatively slow.
Good way to put it. So last question before we go into our vis or vat. Peter, so with everything that's going on right now, I wanted us to look a little bit into the future and see what you have in your mind on that. When you look at AI, when you look at the economy, when you look at the politics, do you feel that we're headed in a positive direction as a species, as a global society? Or do you think the world ahead is very scary?
I think we are headed for a very, very good place. If you zoom out, you know, I think a lot of the doomers, they haven't read enough history. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of human history is tragedy. It is awful. It is rape, murder, slavery. It is a horrible place. Yeah. If you look at the world we live in today, you know, I think previous generations would be astounded that you've got people running around New York wanting to burn the system down. You have no idea how lucky you are and how important it is to keep, you know, the load-bearing walls that are holding up civilization. So with that, when we look at the technologies going forward, I think everybody sort of accepts that most of the technologies running around are positive. So we have new medicines, new treatments, bionics, you know, improvements in semiconductors and computers and things like this. I think the one that people are worried about is AI. Mm-hmm. And specifically, you know, there's a couple of elements that they worry about. There's the surveillance aspect, which I think is 100% there. The productivity or job loss component, I think, is the other big one. So a lot of people are worried that AI is going to take all the jobs. In the short run, I think that it will take millions of jobs, specifically jobs of entry-level, high-paid, white-collar workers. So basically, young people who have cubicle jobs. It's very much focused on those kinds of jobs. The reason is that companies tend to try to hold on to workers. So if they've already had a worker and they find that they can replace the job with an AI, they'll typically find something else for them to do. The other thing is that AI, when it can do a task, it is so efficient. It's like 20 or 100 times more efficient that the company can then grow sales. Right. So it can use the person who was displaced and it can put them on all the other activities that were not yet displaced because the company is growing. So I think that you know, in the short run, yes, you've got millions of people who are at risk. If you zoom out, though, every automation throughout history, so technological unemployment is not new. People always think it's new. They think that we've never seen this before. In Aristotle's age, they worried about oxen replacing field workers. Okay, and they said, you know, what are we going to do? Nobody's going to have a job. We're going to need to start wars to use up all the men. In the Middle Ages, it was water wheels. Okay, water wheels were going to replace everybody. You know, the Industrial Revolution, of course. And if we look at all, the internet was even supposed to replace everybody. If we look at all of these episodes, what they, and there have been thousands of episodes of automation throughout history. And what every single one did is that you had more jobs that paid much better at the end of it. And typically what happens is that the jobs that used to be bad jobs are no longer bad jobs after the automation because everybody's income went up.
That's right.
Right. So for example, if you look before the Industrial Revolution, being a professor was being a beggar. Being an actor was, that was essentially a prostitute. In the early days of professional sports, they all had day jobs. Like baseball players in the 1910s, they would go work at the deli and then they would play baseball in the evening. That's why you had baseball games in the evening, because everybody had to work during the day, right? So playing baseball for a living, if we were in 1910 and you said the machines are going to take all the jobs, and I said, no, that's fine. People can play baseball. You'd say, you know,
yeah,
what?
Would have just, yes.
Right. And so a lot of the jobs that we look down on now, a lot of the blue collar jobs are going to be good jobs on the other side of AI. Now, there was a time when a plumber was not a good job. All right, if you go back to the 1950s, you had a famous show called Honeymooners. I think he was a truck driver you had plumbers in various shows, and they were always cast as a sort of, you know, relatable blue collar everyman. Well, plumbers make six figures now.
Yes.
Right. House painters. A house painter in the U.S. makes $200 a day.
That's right.
In India, they make $9.
Yeah.
That's only half an Industrial Revolution, right? India does have electricity. Okay. So if you take what happened in the Industrial Revolution is all of the crappy jobs pay more. As in New York a couple of years ago, there were two guys unloading cinder blocks off a truck. One of them was talking about how he'd just gotten back from Brazil where he went on vacation with the family. These are guys who load rocks, right?
No.
Go on vacation to Brazil. This is unimaginable before the Industrial Revolution. Yeah. So I think what's going to be fascinating about AI is that in many ways, AI is going to be the opposite of the Industrial Revolution. The people who are going to benefit are going to be the blue collars.
Yeah.
Right. They're going to go from $9 painting a house to $200 painting a house to $3,000 painting a house. You're going to make six figures at Starbucks. Okay. And this is difficult for people to grok, but you have to go back and look at what happened in the Industrial Revolution. AI does not replace physical labor. The Industrial Revolution replaced farm workers.
Yes.
Right. Therefore, all the value that it created went to white collar workers. AI is going to do the opposite. It's going to replace white collar workers. Therefore, all the value it creates is going to go to blue collar workers. So it's almost the opposite of the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah.
So I think today, people who work in the white collar jobs that were crappy jobs, bookkeeping was not a high prestige job before the Industrial Revolution. Okay. So the people who work in those jobs in cubicles, they don't look back and say, you know, I wish I could pitch hay for 10 cents an hour, like they did in the 1800, right? They don't do that. In the future, people who, they make things with their hands, or they have the skilled trades, people who build things, you know, the sort of maker economy, because as incomes go up, people want to buy more handmade things. They want more entertainment. You know, people who do service jobs, pet grooming, personal trainers, people who have those jobs, and they're making six figures doing it, they're not going to look back and say, you know, I miss the days when I could make 50 grand working in a cubicle staring at a wall all day. They're going to pity us for all the jobs that AI is taking. So I'm extremely optimistic. But having said, there is about a 5, 10, maybe 20 year period in between where you're going to have a whole lot of white collars who are going to be dispossessed. And the thing is, those are the people who write the AI doom porn. Okay. Right? Journalists, professors, think tank analysts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, people who write, you know, Gardner tech yep. you know, yep. crystal ball. Those yep. are exactly the people who AI is coming for. Yep. So yeah, yep. they don't like it.
No, I've always said, I've been saying this even before AI came, when we were just talking about robots coming, it was before even AI. And I was saying, please bring them, because it's going to be finally the era where we humans are going to have to be the humans we were destined to be, you know?
Bingo.
And that's what I was thinking about. So that's why I'm excited. Peter, if you would allow me just 2 or 3 minutes, I want to do this part. It's really fun. It's what I call the this or that. It's basically goes very fast. I give you 2 options. You only can pick one. Don't try to explain. If you want to explain, just give 1 sentence so we can move fast, but you'll see what I'm trying to do. Are you ready?
Okay, got it. Yep.
All right. Hayek or Rothbard?
A Rothbard.
All right. Friedman or Mises?
Mises.
Gold standard or Bitcoin standard?
It's Bitcoin standard.
Only one. Thank you.
It's timing, but yes. Okay, Bitcoin standard.
Abolish the Fed or just audit the Fed?
Abolish the Fed.
Zero government regulation or some regulation is necessary?
Zero.
Okay. Homeschooling or unschooling?
Homeschooling.
Doge was a success or Doge was a failure?
Doge was a failure because of Congress.
Open borders or controlled immigration?
Controlled immigration.
I thought I knew that one. Milei's Argentina or Lee Kuan Yew's Singapore?
Milei's Argentina.
What's the best tax? Land value tax, consumption tax, or flat tax?
Consumption tax. Mm-hmm. Which is a flat tax. Yep.
Okay. Democracy is essential for prosperity, or you can have prosperity without democracy. I'm always fighting about this one.
Yeah, you can absolutely have it without democracy.
Thank you, because I agree. The US dollar survives another 50 years or something else replaces it?
Something else replaces it.
Mm-hmm. UBI, interesting idea or terrible idea?
Terrible idea.
Last one. AI is a net positive for jobs or AI is net negative for jobs?
In the long run, massively positive.
Perfect. Well, this is it. I hope you had fun with this.
Yeah, I did. Yep. Yep. Love it. I know. I wanted to comment on every one of those. I was holding back.
I know. But it's designed for that, you know? So you just, we'll let people understand.
That's like holding steak in front of a dog. And
I know.
I just want a taste of that one. Okay.
I know. Next time I'll try to leave you more time so you can respond. But Peter, last word. Where can people find you? Where can people listen to you some more, find your information? Please tell us.
I do daily videos, about 3.5 minutes on economics and freedom. I post those over on X, the artist formerly known as Twitter. And then I do deep dives with charts and all the gory details at profsainange.com.
Thank you so much, Peter. This was really fun, and I hope you enjoyed it as well. And we'll have to get back together again, because I'm sure some of these things will be, evolving.
Oh, they absolutely will be. Yeah. Right. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Bye, Peter.
Bye-bye. Bye.